And I'm very pleased this morning to be able to introduce our first three speakers are all speaking kind of in succession on the same topic, just different aspects of it. And they will be talking about a program that is sponsored by the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, and they're associated with the University of Texas Austin campus. And our first speaker is going to be Frederick Steiner. He is the Dean of the School of Architecture at Texas Austin campus. He has a PhD and an MA degree in the city of in city and regional planning, and a master's regional planning from the University of Pennsylvania. Dean Steiner earned a master's community planning and a BS in design from the University of Cincinnati. His most recent book is Urban Ecological Design and Design for a Vulnerable Planet. So please welcome Dr. Steiner.
That's okay.
Let me help you out here. And
I could talk about Orlando for
you could
5 minutes.
Yeah. You're supposed to be on the toolbar.
Yeah. Right here.
Oh, here. Oh, yeah. And which one is yours?
Sites. I can get it from here. Can everybody hear me okay? Oh, good. It's my job to basically introduce the concept and then turn it over to my two colleagues who will take it into greater depth and also relate not only the SITES initiative, but other things we are doing at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center related to ecosystem design. And how many of you are familiar with SITES? Okay, so about a third. It's a voluntary, very interdisciplinary project that our goal is to basically create and implement a rating system for sustainable land design. One way of explaining it, if you're familiar with the LEED system for buildings, more or less what we're trying to do is create LEED for the outdoors. So this is a very ambitious project. It's also one that has the potential to transform your industry and our industry in very significant ways. In fact, I think it has the potential to transform the planet in very significant ways. We built the SITES system inspired in great amount from the success of the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED system for buildings. And as you can read there, as of now 2 years ago, green building accounted for 25% of all construction activity, and the market is expected to reach $135 billion by the next 3 years. So there's been a tremendous growth in green building, the green building industry, and it's been very successful. So as we began the Sustainable Sites Initiative, these are the guiding principles that we've used as a philosophy to look at the Sustainable Sites Initiative. And you can see in some ways it's very Hippocratic, the notion of first doing no harm, And these principles we've held throughout the process. Most of you are probably familiar with the basic concept of sustainability. It's essentially the balancing of ecological concerns, environmental, economic concerns, and social equity concerns. And the basic framework that was used for sustainable sites was the ecosystem services concept. And the ecosystem services are basically those benefits that we derive from nature. We viewed them in the past as free, but increasingly we're understanding that we need to value ecosystem services. And these are an example. We take a transect across the landscape, and these are the kinds of ecosystem services that the landscape provides for us. So what we want to do with sustainable sites is to enhance ecosystem services and contribute to ecosystem services and not degrade from them. This requires a basic value change in how we are approaching landscape design, and one from that's based on a system of degradation to one that is building stewardship. So we're going from conservation to regenerative design, and so it's a very fundamental change in values. We are currently in the project stage of the Sustainable Sites Initiative. These are some of the kinds of projects that can be addressed with the Sustainable Sites Initiative. You can see everything from streets and plazas to parks and campgrounds to college campuses and botanical gardens. Danelle will come back to the timeline in just a moment, but you can see that we released our guidelines and performance standards in November of 2009. We're currently in the middle of the pilot project stage. The idea is to wrap that up by this June. We will then have revised guidelines and performance benchmarks by 2013, and then have open enrollment in the SITES program by 2013, so about a year from now. The overview of the guidelines is the idea is to measure a site sustainability within the context of ecosystem services. It's a point-based system. It's a 250 point scale. And the idea is to have four levels of of certification. So the more points one gains, the higher level of certification one gains. This is the outline of the categories. And you can see it goes from the site selection to monitoring and innovation. And we're going to drill down a little bit more about these contents in just a moment. There were over 150 registered pilot projects, and they range, and you'll see, across the country and into Canada. We have one project in Iceland that probably was before their banking system collapsed. One in Spain and a couple in Canada. 34 states across the country are represented. And you can see a reasonable distribution of projects. These are the types of projects that have been included in the pilot. A good number you can see of open space, but there's a broad range of projects, and that was our intention. Also, looking at what the existing land uses are, the great majority of projects are on gray fields. There are sort of an equal split between greenfield projects and brownfield projects. Also, a large range in sizes of the pilot projects, ranging from less than 1 acre to over 500 acres. And again, this is the timetable. The project began in 2005, and we're hoping in the next 2 years to wrap it up. And with that, I'll turn it over to Danelle.
Okay, our next speaker is going to be Danielle Paranunzi. She is also with the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center. The project that she's working on, and the three speakers are working on, has three partners: the Lady Bird Johnson Center, the American Society of Landscape Architects, and the U.S. Botanical Gardens. They are creating a national voluntary rating system for sustainable landscapes, and she has been involved since its inception in 2005 and oversees 150 pilot projects voluntarily testing those standards, and they will be revised based on the results of those and hopefully be released. Timelines always slip, but we always try to stick with them. It's in 2013. So, Danielle, if you'd come up. Do I need to change this, or do you just keep going?
Hello, everybody. Thank you for attending the presentation. I'm going to spend the next few slides getting a little bit more, a little deeper into detail with some of the credits in the site's rating system, and to tie it back into compost and where that's addressed and how that's addressed. So I'm going to provide some credit examples. There are 66. I didn't touch anything. Okay. It's showing up here.
No computer signal. Okay.
Just check the paper back.
Oh, that's why.
Not secured.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to go over some credit examples and really talk about it in terms of how we indirectly and directly address compost. So as a selected material, compost use as a recommended strategy, and composting as a best practice. And this will probably be a little clearer after I go through some examples. And then I'll go over the summary and next steps of the site's rating system. And just to go back to this slide to discuss how the structure of the rating system and the way the credits are laid out is following the process of development from site selection to site design to construction, operations, and maintenance. And there's, like I said, 66 credits. 15 of them are prerequisites, so there's base requirements that you have to achieve to even move forward and participate, and then a base level of 100 points from 51 optional credits. So there's several to choose from. And I'm just going to highlight some credits from these sections that where compost is addressed. And it's worth noting that this rating system is really about design and construction, actual design and construction practices, and really a plan and commitment to operate and maintain a certain way. And just to kind of go back to what Fritz was talking about with our how we were influenced by the U.S. Green Building Council and LEED, one of our initial goals was to supplement existing green building standards. So that's actually currently they're proposing some credits based on our work, and we're also creating a standalone rating system, which is what we put out in November 2009 for the pilot phase. And just to show you the structure of an actual credit, if you're not familiar with LEED, it's very similar to a LEED credit. So it's outlined as a credit intent. Really, that's the general goal of that credit. Requirements that we've laid out with several of our technical advisors reviewing that and making that something that is achievable on a national scale, so different regions and different project types can all try to achieve this. Submittal documentation is important because that's how we're verifying compliance. We're not going to each site to make sure that a project is following these requirements or actually requiring certain kinds of documentation to prove compliance. And the potential technologies and strategies are really recommendations for how to achieve credits as much as possible. We really are trying to make this more of a performance-based criteria. So rather than being prescriptive and saying something like you have to have a green roof, it's really more about the performance of the green roof and how it's managing stormwater or cleaning stormwater. So it's really about that end performance that we're looking at. And then links to other sites' credits is really trying to show that there is a lot of the credits are very interrelated, and one practice could help achieve multiple benefits and multiple credit points, and also many resources and definitions. So I'll just go over some of the, not all of these, but I'm going to highlight these credits. These are some of the credits where compost is addressed as a strategy for meeting restoration of shoreline buffers, or when you want to daylight streams and you have to decompact some of those areas, we're recommending compost as a strategy. And then also managing stormwater on site, which I'll talk about a little more detail. This credit here, for example, is 5 to 10 points. And this credit's intent is to replicate the hydrologic conditions. So this is the infiltration rates, the evapotranspiration rates, the runoff rates of the site's historic, natural, and undeveloped ecosystem in the region. And recommend example strategies you can see here. We're promoting soil and vegetation-based methods as much as possible. And here it's used to capture, slow, and treat runoff. And compost-amended soil is a strategy that we recommend. And this is our soils and vegetation series of credits, and I'm really going to highlight the prerequisite here. It's creating a soil management plan. And this is actually something that you would see, it would be used in the construction process, but it's really meant to be to be developed before you get to the construction process to really designate the areas of your site that you don't want to be touched during construction and parts that you want to use for laydown and storage areas. And we want to promote that to be areas that have previously developed or parking lots or things like that. So as much as possible, preserve what's it's existing and healthy. And describe how we're going to restore those soils on site and the treatment details. And here we say, compost amendments is a really great strategy for restoring those soils that have been degraded. And then most importantly is to communicate this plan to the contractor. And material selection, I'm going to talk about the using regional materials credit. And this is where compost as a material is actually selected material that you're going to purchase and bring to your site might play into the site's rating system. So here, we really want to promote regional identity and support regional economy and reduce transportation and the associated emissions from that. Basically lower our carbon footprint by using regional materials. And so compost as a actual purchase material would play here as there's three different point ranges, 30%, 60%, 90% of your material. If it's soils and aggregate, would have to be within 50 miles. Plants within 250 miles, all other materials 500 miles. And these are, again, credits are optional. These are not requirements, but incentives. And then construction here, we're really looking at several credits and prerequisites. Mainly, an obvious one here that might apply is erosion and sediment control and promoting the use of compost, berms, and blankets and socks. And that would really play into a strategy for 7.1. And I'll spend a little bit more time. Oh, and 7.5 is also an important credit in terms of during construction when you're clearing, during your land clearing activities, that you're actually not taking that material that's pretty valuable to the landfill, but that you're composting or mulching it on site or near the site to reduce waste. And this is a pretty important prerequisite that we're learning a lot from in the pilot phase. And this is restoring soils, 100% of your soils that's been disturbed during construction to meet the soil restoration criteria that we've outlined here. And obviously there's not enough time to go through all of this, and Mark is going to spend a lot more time on soils restoration in his talk And we also have a sister credit, credit 7.3, that's really looking at restoring soils from previous development. And so I'll pull out some text from our rating system. And this is an actual organic matter criteria. And we really want projects to amend soils with mature, stable compost. This is our definition of mature, stable compost. A test at 6.0 or higher on the Solvita Compost Maturity Index rating. So this is just kind of giving you a little bit more information on how we've more directly in a requirement talked about compost use as an amendment. And lastly, I'll talk about the operations and maintenance stage. And this is, again, more of a plan and commitment to operate and maintain a certain way. Projects that are going through the pilot program and after an open enrollment were really after construction is completed and they've been occupied, that's when you can get a certified rating. And I'm going to be speaking about the prerequisite 8.1 and 8.3. 8.1 is very important. It's about the maintenance plan, and it's really something that we encourage all team members to participate in the development of and doing it early on. So it's actually could influence design. Too often, maintenance is sort of an afterthought, and there's really ways that you can make your site more efficient and less wasteful if you can think about maintenance strategies. And we provide a worksheet, and this is sort of an example here of some parts in our worksheet where we address composting as an approach to managing excessive organic plant material or actually using it as an amendment. And 8.3, this is where we talk about more of the act of composting as a best practice. And this is similar to the credit in construction for land clearing materials that you would actually manage that material and compost it and mulch it and have it on site or off site. So this is, again, trying to not take valuable materials to the landfill and reducing emissions in terms of transporting that material somewhere else. And it's probably a lot to take in. So just as a summary, directly as part of a credit requirement, we do ask that compost that is used for soil restoration activities is mature, stable compost as defined in sites, that a credit for composting actually recycling yard trimmings on site or within 50 miles during construction and maintenance activities. These are direct ways that compost is addressed. And if you're choosing to bring in a compost, if you're going after the regional materials credit that we ask that's within 50 miles, and indirect ways that compost is used in the rating system is more of as a strategy, and there's just really endless ways that we have talked about compost as an amendment or compost products like blankets, berms, and socks for erosion and sedimentation control, and stormwater management as well. And just to go back to our next steps to kind of put it into where we are now, we're completing our pilot program in 2012. And then in fall 2012, we're also conducting a public comment period, and we'd love to hear from lots of members of U.S. Composting Council or others in this industry to weigh in on some of the new revised credits that we'll be putting out. So we'll put out sort of an abbreviated version of the 2009 credits, but that are revised for the next round. And then during this year and next year, we'll be incorporating that feedback from the pilot projects and from our technical advisors and from the public comment into a new rating system and an expanded reference guide. And just some examples of some of the feedback that we're getting so far from our pilot projects. And then 2013, we expect to have open enrollment for any project that wants to pursue certification. And just to add to that, we are talking with the Green Building Certification Institute as a third-party certifier. Right now, we're certifying in the pilot phase internally to gain that feedback and to field test this rating system. But in the future, we intend it to be a third-party certification system. And we're also conducting educational workshops. And at this point, I'll just pass it on to Mark to get deeper into the practice of this.
Excuse me, where can we get, so we can go ahead and be more informed on giving you the feedback, where can we get
Yes. Okay, very good. This is, it's free to download on Sustainable Sites. Oh, it's actually my next slide. Sustainable Sites. Oh. Sustainablesites.org. Okay. Well, I'm trying to. Here, there it is. Oh. Okay. Sustainablesites.org. Well, you can't remember that, but sustainablesites.org. And if you go to the. Oh, we just changed our website, but it's under the reports or products page, and it's a free download. It's about 200 plus page report, but there it is right here, free to download. And if you sign up for our newsletter, it's under contacts, then you'll be informed of, it's just a quarterly newsletter, you'll be informed of the future public comment period.
I'd like to move on to the next speaker and save your questions. You'll have time to answer or ask questions at the end. So.
Okay.
Write that down. If you're like me, I'll forget.
I would like to save the questions for the end. Our next speaker is Mark Simons, and he is the Director of Ecosystem Design Group at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center at University of Texas, Austin. He is a graduate of the University of Cape Town and has his Master in Science in Botany, I wanted to say botanical, same thing, but botany, and has received his ecology PhD from Texas A&M University. He lectures widely on his group's research consulting projects, which focus on sustainable and regenerative landscapes, including green roofs, native turf grass, urban prairies, prescribed fires, invasive species control, and urban green space restoration. He consults with local national clients, including the Army Corps of Engineers, the George Bush Presidential Center, NASA, National Parks, and the National Park Service. He sits on several advisory and technical committees, including the Sustainable Sites Initiative and the Clinton Climate Initiative. And so, we have to bring up another presentation? Well, we'll see if it's here. You can do it?
Mm-hmm.
You're probably more technically qualified than I am. So.
I think it got taken off. Let me have a look here. Yes, it did. Somebody erased it.
Somehow it got deleted.
So I'm glad to hear my presentation's been erased. Bad news is I've got a backup here.
Oh, darn.
Ready? Where it's not there, so.
Revolving?
That's not me.
No, that's not you. No. The other one's Sally.
Yeah, it was actually, it already was deleted. Now give me 1 second here. Put it back on. Oh, let's try that one. Okay, good, we're in business.
All right, so let's do the down in the corner here.
Yeah. Okay, so one other thing before, just while we're on books, there has also been a book published by Wiley, edited by Meg Culkin, which is also goes into a bit more detail than the downloadable handbook. It's called the Sustainable Sites Handbook. I can have it up here after the talk if you're interested in it. So I've been involved in sites since its inception. I'm now directing the Ecosystem Design Group at the Wildflower Center, which is, we were kind of mixed, as you heard, between research and consulting and teaching. We teach workshops at UT, so we're sort of like an ag, being a graduate of Texas A&M, as you can tell by my accent, we're sort of an ag extension, sort of part of UT. But the interesting thing is that I've been involved and had to get on this steep learning curve the last 10 years on specifying compost for a lot of our projects, and also for a lot of our research. So we're particularly interested in the role of compost, and being on the technical committee with sustainable sites has raised all this awareness about how careful we have to be about how to specify compost. As Danielle said, it's in there. We don't want to be prescriptive in sites, but there's a lot of endpoints to get those specific credits where we say, okay, compost industry, it's up to you to get this right. And I'm going to particularly focus on... this one's not going to work. Let's try it. Down doesn't work. Let's try this one again. Hang on. Yep, no, I got it. Let's try that. Yeah, got it. It's working. So, as you heard from Fritz, it's all based on the science, is all based fundamentally on ecosystem services, the things that plants do for us. And so, what Sustainable Sites is trying to do is to capture all those functions, cleaning the air, producing oxygen, creating habitat, and optimizing that as much as possible. We can't necessarily maximize it, but at least when we're designing a landscape, we can optimize it so that all the features we want are there. But systems are kind of complex, as you know, and when we're looking at specific systems where compost is involved, we're particularly looking at native revegetation. Revegetation and native revegetation are both within sustainable sites. It doesn't have to be native. But some of these, we want them to be sustainable. To be sustainable means to be low input. And if it's low input and we're dealing with plants, we have to think about the soil. And my interest is particularly in the plant-soil relationship. And if you want to get something like this to grow, we can't necessarily treat this like a bed of petunias or your tomatoes in your backyard, or an even agricultural system, simply because it has different requirements to a high-input agricultural horticultural system. And right now, some of the projects that we've been involved in, like this is the Miller Prairie, where we had to put a prairie back on almost grayfield / brownfield soils out at the airport here in Austin, and we had to recreate that. Well, that called for a very specific compost spec to restore. I mean, this is under the old park. Those of you who are residents of Austin, this is under the parking lot, what was the former parking lot there at the old airport with that beautiful control tower there that they've left, thank goodness. To get the soils right here, to restore it, only we had to start from scratch. We had the blackland soil, the clay was there, but the organic matter was gone. So then we had to say, well, how are we going to get that back? What do we shoot for? Because the existing specifications of compost that were out there weren't necessarily suitable, and I'll get into that in a second. Then there's green roofs. Green roofs are, I've been doing green roof research since about 2004. And again, here's another aspect where they're drifting away from the sort of European model of sedums growing on gravel to prairie systems, like this one in Vancouver. There's our research at the Wildflower Center. We've been doing that for several years. And we're now putting compost in on green roofs, but we have to put it on low levels if water quality is a problem. We don't want nitrates and phosphates pouring out of there into our water system. So there's another role there, again, for a different type of specification. And then, of course, there's the turf grass systems. Now, turf grass has been demonized pretty much right now because of the high inputs, mowing, watering, fertilizer, herbicide, etc. But there's other ways to do lawns. This is a temperate lawn, clearly, but it's totally sustainable. It's at equilibrium. You know, it has to be mowed or grazed, but it doesn't have to be. We don't have to be pouring chemicals on that. It doesn't need it. So there is a way to design a sustainable system. What ecologists would call that equilibrium, which a sort of conventional lawn isn't necessarily. This is some of our turf grass research. We've been looking at that at the center. So I'm just going to focus then on the role of compost in these for ecological restoration of native plants, because this is where I think there's a whole new market for the industry, and we've been struggling to find the right products for the different projects I've been working on. The San Antonio River, the Bush Library you heard about, the Miller, where we've been trying to find the right compost for a native ecological restoration. Now we know, this is the San Antonio River, we know compost is good, generally. We start from there. And there was an interesting study that was done in Texas a few years ago with Tarleton University and UT, where they looked at the characteristics of hydromulch versus compost at different levels versus doing nothing and putting it on Bermuda grass. So they're interested in what was the runoff, how fast did the vegetation establish, and look at the comparison. And it was kind of interesting from the vegetation perspective. If you look at this as a time series and the amount of vegetation cover, which is what the engineers are most keen to sign off on, when you look at using compost, it was really good. In a couple of months, 2 or 3 months, you're getting 100% cover. This Adams et al. Report, TCEQ EPA report, is online, but you can download it. When you looked at hydromulch, it took considerably slower. So to get up to 100% cover, we're looking at over 8 months compared to, say, 2.5, 3 months. And, of course, just bare dirt took even longer still. So clearly, compost wins this competition. It definitely helped to use compost, and engineers will look at it and say, geez, I'm not going for hydromulch this time, I'm going for compost. And incidentally, hydromulch, this was with Bermuda grass, hydromulch is even less efficient on natives because of the size of the seed, curiously. So compost is good because you can establish vegetation faster. There was also less sediment load coming off on compost. You put compost in reducing soil erosion, and again, that's well known in the industry. Interestingly, the phosphorus and nitrogen, which are usually the two big pollutants, that and dissolved organic carbon coming off organic systems, was less. But as I'm sure you've seen this before, but there's a lot of dissolved phosphate, which is a problem. So there was high levels of phosphate coming in on the runoff, which wasn't good compared to the other treatments. So, and that's bad, not just because of water pollution, but you have high phosphorus going into the soil, and if you're thinking about ecological restoration, and this was Bermuda grass that we didn't care, but then you're going to promote weeds, and weeds in ecological restoration is a problem. They may even be native, but they're plants which can luxury consume that phosphorus, and they push out everything else. And suddenly you've lost, you know, $20,000 worth of native seed has been swamped out by one or two species of weed, and that is an issue. And that's one of the reasons why we're trying to bring down that nutrient level of compost. And interestingly, with native systems, if you want to do restoration, now I want to point out that restoration, native plants, these are all very high scorers in the site's credit system. You can double dip on these. So these are very enticing for the designer. So they're going to want to do native landscapes. They're going to want to do restoration. But if you look at a graph there of nutrient concentration going from left to right, so it's high concentration on the right, there comes a point when there's an optimum amount of nutrients. Very high nutrient systems are very low diversity. Low nutrient systems, up to a point where it's peaking out there, top of that bell curve, are high diversity. You think of rainforests, Mediterranean ecosystems, even grasslands are actually very nutrient systems, and they're very species rich. You start piling on high nutrient levels and even high organic matter, and suddenly there's only a few species which can use that, and you push out all your diversity. And diversity is an important thing in these systems if you want to restore them. If you look at what the levels are, for those of you who I'm sure you're tired of looking at compost analyses, but these are the levels in the soil. And the key ones to look at there are the ammonium, the NH4, the nitrate, the NO3, and the phosphate, the PTO5 there. Look at those levels. Those are in parts per million or milligrams per kilogram. They're metric units. But you see those little levels. Now, if we compare that to what you find in compost, and the values, don't worry, the range has changed a bit, but the order of magnitude is what's important here. We're talking about 10, 100,000 times higher nutrient levels. And that is, if we want to get to that prairie soil level, we've got to do some, either be a thin dusting of your compost at almost a rate that's probably impractical, or you're going to have to dilute it at source, which nobody wants to do, because then you've got to dilute it and you've got to get all this bulk you've got to pull in. So this is one of the areas where I think we're going to have to do some more work on how to get compost levels down. Because here's the thing we found. You may be able to get your nitrogen down. But if you've got those of you who know anything about phosphorus, nitrogen is cycled through the air. Most of what we breathe is nitrogen. You can get rid of excess nitrogen with time. You can't get rid of excess phosphorus. Phosphorus gets in the system, it stays there. So the nitrogen compounds and the phosphorus compounds, it's sometimes hard to balance if you want to get them down to those levels. You may be able to do one through amendments, but it's hard to do both. And the other thing about this is these native systems are curiously dependent on soil biology. So when you think of agricultural systems, they've been sort of bred and end up where we can have the soil and we can just load them with nutrients to produce a good crop. It's very successful. It appears that most native species and complex communities are very dependent on soil biology. Without it, they don't work. There are some species which aren't dependent, but some seem to be very, very dependent on, sometimes on individual species of bacteria and or species of fungi. So that's a close-knit system, and that's a hard thing to recreate. But it's something that the compost industry is already interested in because they already know about the role of bacteria and fungus and the way it's degraded, in a way it degrades organic material. This is from a paper in Nature sometime a few years ago, 98. When they looked at the number of fungal species, and these are arbuscular mycorrhizae, different species of fungal, when they started loading them in, this is a greenhouse experiment, they found the more, this is looking at native species, the more fungal species they put in, the greater the diversity, the species richness. That Shannon's diversity is a bit of an odd index. It's an index of a number of species and how much there is of each one. So the more species you put in, the more diverse. When you looked at shoot biomass, the total shoot biomass that you could crop off a prairie, this was the prairie species, again, the more species you put in kind of peaked there, around 8 or 9 species of fungus. Plant phosphorus increased as you put increased the number of arbuscular mycorrhizae in, these fungus. And conversely, when you look at what was happening in the soil was going down. So the more fungal species you had in, the more efficient it was is extracting that phosphorus out of the soil. And remember, we live on a phosphorus-limited planet. phosphorus is the thing which is in short supply. It's hard to, the deposits of it are hard to find. And when you find them, you know, when we've used it up, and it gets diluted in the system. So phosphorus is kind of critical. But these species have a design to that. They've evolved with low phosphorus, and they know how to harvest it. But if you have very low fungal diversity at the left-hand side of the axis there, the origin, there's high soil phosphorus, and obviously it decreases as the plants sequester it. And there's a sort of picture of these mycorrhizae are obviously an important role in the system. So the question is then, okay, from your perspective, how do we get them in the soil? And this is where it all gets a bit kind of squirrely, because this came out in Science a couple of years ago with Jim Harris in Britain. And he was looking at the ratios, the fungal to bacterial ratio, and I'm sure you're familiar with those, in soils, not in compost, in soils with respect to the biomass, how much stuff's actually in the soil which is living, either fungus, bacteria, or whatever's alive in there. And as you increase the fungal bacterial ratio, the system changed. It went from like raw soil to early successional species, weeds, essentially grasses, then to a late grass, I mean the very developed grass, I'm thinking of a prairie, and that has much higher fungal bacterial ratios, more fungus to bacteria. And then as you became more woody, went to wood and scrub, the soil biomass goes down, but the fungal bacterial ratio keeps going up. And that's what they call succession, that kind of from raw substrate to grass and to forest is what happens with a lot of our systems on this planet. So you can see that the fungus to bacterial ratio was really key here. But that was measuring what was there in situ. And so the question is for the restorationists, and this is for science, is, well, if I want to put a grassland back where there was no grassland, think Miller Prairie, think the SMU campus in Dallas, how do I get to that using compost? Well, this would suggest that maybe you can shortcut it. If I can get that fungal bacterial ratio in my soil high enough, then maybe that will help facilitate this grassland. I'll put all my grassland seeds in, and it will help it. Well, that's what that would imply. But right now, and some people in the compost industry are promoting that, saying use our compost because it's got a high fungal bacterial ratio and that will help you get there. And that may be true. But the evidence right now doesn't necessarily support that. So though it seems right in theory, this is where I think the big opportunity for this industry and for restoration generally. I'll come back to that right at the end. I've got a couple more slides. So with compost specs, where are we with this kind of restoration thing? Well, with our experience, it's been very difficult to use conventional compost specifications to get to something that we want, to specify, and then if we do specify, expecting the industry to come up with what we want. I mean, here on the San Antonio River, we've got 8 miles, so we're putting compost across either bank on 8 miles of the San Antonio River. That's a lot. We're talking about a lot of organic material. And when we first did it, we were getting this. We're getting, you know, shredded 2x4s. It's not compost. It hit some aspects of the specification, but not really much at all. It was just crushed, you know, recognizable wood. I mean, in the specification, we said it must be well decomposed. I don't call that well decomposed. Mustn't resemble the raw material. Well, that still looks like wood to me. So it was hard then to say, well, you just brought down, you know, 4 tons of this. Can you take it back, please? So we realized what we're doing now is we're going to the source and inspecting it there before it arrives on site. So we can get closer to what we want. We understand it's not perfect. We'll never get it exactly right, but we want to get it as close as we can. In the end, when we got the compost we wanted, it worked fine. It just took us a while to get there. And here's where we are right now, then, with the compost specifications, what we think we can expect from the industry to do this, to get these native landscapes back in. We do want very fine texture, and that takes off some of that undecomposed wood. You're always going to get that if it has a large woody component originally from the raw material. And so we can, to some extent, sieve that out. I'd even say that screen size can even go lower if you want a higher quality one, but 5/8 is what we've been using, but we've been, depending on the project, we've been plus or minus. You can also specify the particle length, which is another good way to help specify it. But here's the hard part. It's this low nitrate and low available phosphate. And what we've realized over the last few years is then what people do is they try and dilute it with organic matter, and that's probably why there's so much wood in there. And then, you know, the wood isn't decomposed, it's going to suck up all the nitrogen, and by the time it gets on site, God knows what you're going to get in there. So this has been hard to achieve. And what we're saying now is you can dilute with non-organic material if you want to get it down to that. And that can be done on site. So, for instance, if you've got some compost which is well decomposed, but the phosphorus is still high, then maybe what the thing to do is to bring it and we'll mix it on site with abiotic material, like even sand, to get it down. But don't use organic material to get it down, because that will mess it out in the long run. Then there's a high fungal bacterial ratio. We're putting it in, but this area needs some needs more research because we're not really there yet, and that's an area that I think we've got to call to arms to really find out, for restoration of native landscapes, how are we going to get there? How are we going to get to a fungal bacterial ratio which is correct, and even if it matters? So that's an area for future research. So finally, so what we need then is these methods to produce low nutrient but high quality compost. So we want it well decomposed with these low levels of nitrogen and phosphorus. And then find a way to quantify the nutrient and biota levels for these applications. What I'm saying there is really just emphasizing that the biology part of compost, we need to get more involved in. And there's a lot of tales out there, and we don't know if they're right or wrong. And this needs some far more rigorous scientific research, which is what we're hoping to do at the center. Thanks very much. Welcome. Do you want to do questions for our group now?
Yeah. Would you like to come up with the other two speakers, and we'll take some questions right now?
So, you had a question.
Most likely, we're working on just one central location, but it is we do have technical advisors all over the country, so it is meant to be regional, and in the future, it might be something that has regional chapters or things like that, but right now, we're just having one location.
The U.S. Green Building Certification Institute will be the entity, we think, that will actually certify the projects. And they're distributed across. They have testing centers, so it'll be pretty much the way LEED is as far as your ability to get a project certified through that.
Oh yeah, it'll be a national projects nationally can go after a rating system if that's.
Right. It seems that from what we've been sourcing through Texas, we've gone through probably over 30 different compost producers, and it seems like the best the stuff we've seen the best, which gets closest, is this the static pile, and it's time, it's the time thing, which I know works against you, but and making sure it's moist. There's all the static pile stuff, which is just well managed. But like I say, I don't want to bias this and saying we have to have those high fungal, low bacterial ones because it still needs considerably more testing for a lot of these systems. But yeah, but static, I think if we can find a way, if you can partially designate, if the market really does pick up on this eventually, then I think reserving some for static pile and getting that high quality, high biota compost, there's probably going to be a market for it.
Back over here.
Guidelines, but it can be superseded by
You know, and I agree, and we've certainly had exactly the same experience. It's been one of the prereqs, and Daniel didn't talk about it in detail, one of the prereqs sustainable sites is having a multidisciplinary team from the get-go. One of the problems in the past has been bringing the landscape architect, the people who are probably doing they bring on coming too late. And now the engineer has all the trump cards up his sleeve, and then he'll do exactly what you said, and he'll trump it. So there's kind of a political kind of issue here, but I totally agree with you. I think yes, we have to be lenient on the compost specification. I've learned that over the last decade. But equally, I think getting on the same, the part of the sustainable sites is to prevent that from happening, is that everybody's on the same page right at the early part of the design stage. In some cases, that happens. We even have to bring a soil scientist on because of the site assessment. So you've got those experts at the front end, not, what's left in the budget for the landscape architect at the back end when suddenly it's all too late. So I agree with you, and I think sites is trying to address that.
Okay, right here.
No, we haven't done any research on compost other than what we've been using for turf grass and for green roofs. So it's been very specific where we just specified it. But trying out, I haven't worked with biosolids at all. I'm aware of them, but we haven't used them. I have no problem with using biosolids. But I would like to do some research specifically aimed at looking at these different. This is, I think, research which is needed on lots of levels, but we haven't got there yet. But I do think that the raw materials, which is a real issue. The nice thing about composting is if we can specify the general end product, within ranges, within practical ranges, I don't see any difficulty using most raw materials at all.
Other question. I'm going to hold off on you because you've asked one, and I'll go with this gentleman right here in the second, fourth row, right there.
How do you define green fields and gray fields and brown fields? I've heard of brown fields, and I can imagine the other two, but I'd like a definition.
Sure. Green fields is undeveloped land, and so that's just anything that's in a pretty healthy state. A gray field is something that's previously developed, something that has impervious surface. It could be an abandoned, shopping mall, or just something that's significantly graded. Just basically the land has been altered significantly and the soil has been disturbed to a certain level. And then a brownfield has gone to a level where it's really contaminated. The soil's contaminated or perceived to be contaminated.
Okay. Right here in the front.
Well, when you look at LEED, when we started, essentially it was very building focused. There and the part that had to do with the outdoor environment was essentially use native plants and conserve water, both very good things. So our goal was to increase the outdoor attention in LEED, and that's, as Danelle mentioned. Already, the U.S. Green Building Council has incorporated sustainable sites in their most recent editions of their work. So the idea is that sustainable sites will be incorporated into LEED, but what happens for projects that don't have any buildings? So the idea is to create a system where it can be certified without necessarily there being a building on the site, or there could be a parallel certification processes for the building and the site. The reality was that in the incorporation of LEED, the amount of attention and the amount of knowledge about building energy efficient buildings was advanced substantially through the LEED system, but there was very, if you look at a lot of the LEED projects in the past, very little attention to the landscape.
The outdoor portion of LEED is about 4%, so
correct.
To extend that?
Well, it could stay 4%.
We're saying that you could flip that. The building component of sustainable sites is probably less than 4%.
Okay. I'm going to take a couple more questions, and then we're going to move on so our next speaker has enough time. And let's see, you two will do, and you can decide who goes first, and then we'll go move on.
The first one was about for professionals to get training and certification, like a lead AP. We did put out a survey end of last year to assess the feasibility of an interest in a professional credentialing program based on Sustainable Sites Initiative, and there was a good positive response, and so we are exploring that simultaneously with the Green Building Certification Institute of doing something similar for professionals. So it would be looking at a project certification role, pathway, but also something for professionals as well. So that if you keep on our newsletter email, you'll hear updates on that. And the second one was about inside the buildings compost for users. We describe sites as really addressing from the building skin out because there's already lots of green building rating systems. We do, with that said, deal with composting food waste and give points for that. So that is addressed in there, not necessarily for inside the building, but maybe for if there's a restaurant or outdoor cafe or things like that. There's a lot of things that we're learning during pilot it's hard to separate sometimes the building activities from the site activities. So we're just kind of revising that based on some of that feedback, but we are thinking about that. And in terms of edible gardens and community gardens, we don't have a credit specifically about that because we're trying to make it more performance-based, but it is throughout the rating system where we don't penalize projects if they do use potable water for irrigating a community garden. It's actually exempt from those